Welcome. This is William Evans, and you're listening to Shifting Gears. Dr. Will Bledsoe returns today for a second conversation about a restorative way. Thank you for speaking with us again.
Well, thank you. It's good to be here.
In 1998, you had a pivotal moment as a guest at the University of Colorado Law School, and it illuminated your engagement with restorative justice.
Yes.
What did you experience?
It's tough to put in simple words, but because I had been teaching Native American religious traditions, it was the first time that I experienced a worldview that held relationship as the nature of relationships, human relationships, relationships with all living things and the natural world. It was the first time that I had experienced the worldview of balance and harmony and beauty that I had been teaching about Native American ceremony. It's the first time that I saw it being enacted in a secular setting, justice. And as the Supreme Court, the three-panel Supreme Court, was explaining their approach to justice as the repair of harm and the restoration of relationships in a justice setting, it was the first time that I saw sort of the intersection of a sacred worldview being enacted in a formal justice proceeding.
A you and me world.
A you and me and all of us world, because, you know, the goal of that I learned that day, the goal of restorative justice is to restore a relationship back to a place of balance and harmony, not just between individuals, but with all that is.
You were included. Everybody in that auditorium was included.
Yeah.
You were a family in a peaceful ceremony of emergence at the bubbling spring of source water.
That's beautiful. Actually, I was just trying to understand what they were doing. The Navajo courts conducted an actual trial at CU's law school, and I was teaching Native American religious traditions at the time, working on a master's in religious studies. And the Navajo Supreme Court is comprised of three judges. And this particular case was a Navajo woman who was driving a van, I believe it was for the University of New Mexico, but she was not covered under the insurance policy, and she got into an accident and sustained some pretty substantial injuries. And during the trial, one of the Supreme Court judges, Robert Yazzie, asked the lawyers for the insurance company, who were claiming that they were not responsible and not liable for the injuries because the woman wasn't covered under the insurance policy. And what Chief Justice Yazzie explained was that, you know, it doesn't matter if the way he explained it was remarkable. He said, if a person is hungry, it doesn't matter if I am responsible for causing that hunger. I am responsible for feeding that person. And the same is true with injury. If a person is injured or hurt, it doesn't matter whether I caused that hurt. I have a responsibility for helping that person to heal. And so it really, and he said, this emphasizes restoration over punishment. And it just blew me away.
And in that experience, you tasted the source water, and you begin healing yourself in a way that enabled you to aid others in healing.
Yes.
And today you aid them by holding a space of safety where they're able to remember who they are and their interconnection with all their relatives.
Exactly. The restorative approach to human misconduct and criminal behavior, and also conduct in schools, is fundamentally about healing and about the restoration of relationships.
In our original conversation, you mentioned a Boulder municipal judge, Linda Cook, I believe, ask you whether you had the ability to grow a restorative justice program for university students living off campus.
Yes. And I saw that as a tremendous opportunity, not only for me, but for the community of Boulder. I knew immediately that I was being given an opportunity to implement and to advance what I had been experiencing in restorative justice, because in 2001, I trained as a restorative justice facilitator. And so when the opportunity to build a program at CU came along, boy, I jumped at it to get deeper into this practice.
Give us some details about the young people and how they responded in the early days of the program.
Yeah, well, a lot of the students had an attitude when they first came into the program and met me, because they you know, college students are for the most part very entitled, and not jumping to the chance to assume responsibility. But this particular case represents the epitome of what this process can provide. So this particular student, male student, was a junior, and he was in the business school, and he threw a party that got out of hand off campus, and in the course of that party, there were all kinds of fights, and he was subsequently charged with a nuisance party, misdemeanor violation, but then also assault. And so when he came to see me, you know, he wasn't really fessing up for his part of the nuisance party. And then his excuse for the fight was, well, I was drunk. And in the process of working with him, I helped him. Actually, the question I asked him was, let me ask you, if your grandmother lived next door to you, would you have thrown this party? And he said, well, absolutely not. And I said, well, did you know that there are two elderly sisters that are in their 80s that live two houses down from you? And when that night happened and you threw that party and there were fights and screaming and yelling and loud noise all around, you terrified those two sisters. And they are still living there because they can't afford to move. And when I said that, I think it really hit home how his behavior and his decisions impacted other people. And it impacted him on a personal level because I essentially activated the way he felt about his own grandmother. And so that's exactly what Justice Yazzie was saying in the Navajo court trial that I witnessed at the law school.
Well, this is a critical moment.
It was
a process of restoration. It's critical because when you first told me about this, you said he had an attitude.
Yeah. Yeah.
He was resistant. And in that moment, however you do it uniquely, that's when the ice melts.
Yeah.
When the water begins to flow in life-sustaining ways.
Yes, yes.
Or a kid freezes up and contracts and forgets who he was and forgets his relatives.
Yeah, exactly. He forgot that he still belonged to a web of relationships that, even though his family wasn't there, nevertheless existed in that community of Boulder. What's interesting is that one of the violations that happened at that nuisance party was public urination. And so when he first came in, he said, well, what am I going to have to do? And I said, well, you're going to have to apologize to a lot of people, and you're going to have to meet with the police officer who said you were rude to him, and you're going to have to, you know, write amends letters and to these neighbors of yours, and you know, you're going to have to do some community service. You're going to have to basically pick up the trash that your party created. And when I said that, he just said, oh, I'm not going to do that. I'm not responsible for, you know, urinating on the sidewalk. And, you know, the other guy picked the fight and I was drunk and he was going on and on and on. I just looked at him and I said, and that's when I pulled out the story of, you know, of the two elderly sisters living down the street. But to answer your question, that change moment that happens, that aha moment where somebody who has done something realizes the human impact of their actions, that's when the process activates a remorse in the offender. And that remorse then turns to an empathy for the other person that they caused harm to. And to me, that's the core change mechanism that rather than excluding a person and punishing them, which wouldn't give them that experience, brings them further into the center of the community. And it's a beautiful experience.
So you begin to see healing as you started to do this for Judge Cook.
Oh, yeah.
And instead of receiving punishment, students began experiencing peace within themselves and in their relationships.
Well, I think first and foremost, it was a moment of holding a mirror up to yourself. It was a moment of self-reflection. And, you know, when you talk about healing, there are layers of healing that happen through the process. You know, in the criminal justice system, and in this case with the CU program, that initial healing is with the social relationships, the relationship with the police officers, the relationship with neighbors. But the deeper layer of healing, and this is what, you know, the Navajo peacemaking courts told us about, is that there's a deeper level of healing, and that's the healing of the individual. In other words, the relationship an individual has with themselves. And so many cases that came through the program, in the process of having these discussions, we were able to identify other unresolved issues, behavioral issues that were happening, whether it was alcoholism or drug addiction.
This is William Evans. You're listening to KDNK, Shifting Gears, and a conversation with Dr. Will Bledsoe about a restorative way. Have you kept in contact with any of these young people who entered your system? What's happened to them?
I have, actually. this particular student that I was talking about with the party, he was so moved by what he had experienced. And we had discussions about bullying. And I asked him, I said, why did you start the fight? And he said, well, I always start the fights so I don't get beat up. And I said, were you bullied in high school? And he said, yes. And so we talked about that. We talked about bullying. And that led into discussions about you know, other things that were happening in his own family. But he went on, I actually trained him to become a facilitator for the program.
Okay.
And once he graduated from business school, he went in and got a master's in restorative justice and later traveled to Ireland, to Brazil, to New Zealand, and worked at community mediation centers doing restorative mediation. So,
Wow. Yeah,
talk about a beautiful story.
In our first conversation, I asked you what you trusted about a restorative way, and you responded you trusted the outcomes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I trust that the process delivers the outcomes. And I also, even deeper than that, I fundamentally believe that there is something in us that quests for balance and harmony and peace. And
quest for balance, harmony, and peace.
Yes. In our relationships with ourselves, with the natural world, with our families and schools and communities. And, you know, I just trust that that's there. And because the restorative way, because the restorative process is a very practical, structured process, it brings people to that realization during the process. And that's when the transformation and healing happens. So I trust the process and I trust the outcomes because I've done so many of these and seen that happen time and time and time again.
How many have you done?
I've done probably over 1,000 restorative encounters. Sometimes it's just conversations, but oftentimes it's an actual formal conference, whether it was for schools or, the justice system. That first year at CU, I was the only facilitator, so I did pretty much all the cases.
You personally have been through the process of stepping across the threshold into the unknown, and from what you've told me, many of the people you're working with have that experience as well.
Yes.
Can you talk about that moment or the moments preceding it? Are you motivated by desperation or courage?
It's not desperation. It's I'm motivated by the experience of profound beauty that happens when people come together and talk about painful interactions. I'm continually inspired by the spirit of this thing. And, you know, as far as my own personal conviction, you know, I was facilitating conferences for the Longmont Community Justice Partnership and also CU. And one day I came home after a conference and I was confronted by how little restoration had happened in my own life and how little had been reconciled with things that had happened to me and things that I had done. And so I was presented with the opportunity to use the restorative mechanism and process to help me heal historical wounds.
What signals do you get when you're with a group that's traveling under the canopy of restoration, but not in alignment with what's best for all concerned?
Well, you know, I've participated in conferences with other facilitators. And, you know, as we spoke last time, a lot of times if people get attracted to restorative justice and restorative school discipline because they have something in themselves, probably like I did, that needed to be restored. And if they're unaware of that, if they haven't done their own work, then they can carry that into the circle with them. And, you know, there is something in us all that can spot inauthenticity very quickly. And so, you know, for me, I observe body language. And if a facilitator is not present and not sincere in their craft, then they can lose they fail to establish a sense of safety and openness in the circle, and the other people in the circle sense it, and you can see it in their body language.
Yeah, I think when safety leaves, people start to shut down, and if they don't physically leave, they're spiritually not connected anymore.
They're not present. Yeah. And that's the danger of restorative practices. And that's also why, you know, I really become frustrated with schools that try to adopt restorative, quote, discipline practices, and they don't realize that it is, at its core, a process of communication. And that requires, you know, really understanding how to listen and what language to use and how to be empathically attuned to the experience of the other people that are talking about these challenging issues.
Yeah, my water isn't very settled and clear when I don't feel safe.
Yeah, it's stormy weather inside.
A friend said to me once, how we treat source water is a measure of our integrity.
Wow. Yes.
So on a personal level, how do you stabilize your restorative integrity on a day-to-day basis?
Well, there's really two answers to that. One is the personal. In other words, what do I do to make sure that I'm in constant process of restoration? And then the second is professional. And because I've been doing this for so long, you know, I'm very, I think I'm pretty clear about what is restorative and what is not. And that really informs my work with organizations and schools because, you know, I can go in and train a school in restorative practices, but if they have a behavioral policy that's loaded with, you know, evaluative language and it's deficit focused and it's all about sanctioning and punishment and exclusion, then those practices aren't going to be embedded in the school culture or the workplace culture. So in other words, when I come in, you know, to a site, the first thing I do is look at their policy. And I say, well, I can put these practices in here, but you're not going to take them. It's not going to become the way you do the business of resolving conflict.
If you're attached to the punitive model.
Exactly. And oftentimes we don't know that we are because it's a paradigm.
Well, and we've pretty much been educated that that's the way you do it.
Exactly. It's the way our justice systems are. It's the way our corporations are structured.
So if I understand correctly, if you get agreement about a positive approach,
mm-hmm.
You train a community or a school to self-maintain, and the goal is for them to be self-sufficient.
It is, and that begins in the classroom. You know, I don't know about you, but when I was growing up, if you got out of line, they sent you to the vice principal's office, and the vice principal was essentially the enforcer for the school. But, you know, restorative communication practices happen in the moment. And so when you train teachers in restorative language, when you train teachers, when you help teachers to be able to spot things like unresolved trauma and anxiety, and then teach them the necessary communication skills to work with that stressed student or individual, you give them the skills to be able to co-regulate their nervous system, as you and I talked about, and establish immediate connection. And if you can do that then, you know, the behavior has a better chance of stopping right then and there rather than continuing on throughout the day and possibly escalating off campus.
Is there more you can say to us about trust?
Well, I think trust is non-negotiable, especially when you're working with somebody who is struggling with the way they feel or they're thinking. If you don't establish trust with that person, then it's going to be very, very difficult to get them to open up and to acknowledge their own needs and to identify what they're feeling and then move into a discussion. Well, let's take a look at the thinking and the believing that lies underneath what you did. So trust is absolutely, that's why they call it sacred trust.
What qualities in a school or organization signal to you that there's probably a favorable outcome possible here?
Well, one of the reasons why I work in schools is because I think that the vast majority of teachers and educators and administrators get into education because there's something in them. It's a calling. And so that desire and that motivation to not just teach academic subjects, but to actually grow lifetime learners and, you know, good people, civil-minded people, good citizens. That cultural soil is there. And all the restorative way is just a series of skills and practices and processes that give them the tools to be able to help them grow socially responsible students.
I think most of us would like a blessing on our right to be.
Oh, exactly, exactly. You know, and our country is in very difficult circumstances.
A lot of confusion.
A lot of confusion, but that can be transformed.
Thank you, Dr. Bledsoe.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Shifting Gears and a conversation about a restorative way. This is KDNK. Thank you for listening.